Then we can move into open public input. I think we have a couple people who've signed up to testify. I'll go through once again. I know that you are old hands at this, but the commission has rules, and we allow each citizen 3 minutes to present their testimony. We'd like you to come forward, sit in front of a mic. You don't have to speak too closely to the mic. Just give yourself about 4 or 5 inches from the mic. And you have 3 minutes. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up, and we'd like you to conclude your remarks. The first person who signed up is Gordon Rue. If you'd come forward, please.
And I did have some handouts for the commission.
Okay, you can give those tape.
I submitted them when I first signed them, so hopefully those got distributed. Madam Chair, members of the commission, my name is Gordon Rue. I'm from Camino Island, a member of the Snow King chapter of Puget Sound Anglers. I'm here to talk to you specifically about the commercial smelt fishery on the north end of Camino Island. In 2009, I drafted a letter, submitted it amongst my neighbors up there at the north end of the island. We were becoming increasingly concerned about the impacts that the smelt fishery was having on the localized population right at the very north end. And what we've seen is over the years, we've gone from 1 to 2 to 3 commercial smelters. They all target the exact same area. And one of the things we noted in that we've seen a decrease in the amount of smelt available for recreational harvest as commercial catches have increased in that area. We've also witnessed a situation where commercial fishers exceed their capabilities to offload the fish from their boats onto their trucks. The excess catch is just simply dropped back into the bay. So I submitted this position in 2009 to the director and fish program managers. We didn't seem to get any traction with that. I came back in front of the commission in 2010, gave public testimony again in this exact same forum. Basically, just paraphrasing from my testimony then, I said, currently commercial harvest takes place 5 days per week and is open 24 hours per day. Late night and early morning fishing has resulted in conflicts between homeowners and fishermen due to noise and bright lights used to spot and attract the fish. The beach seining takes place right in front of people's homes. The Island County Sheriff's Department has responded to numerous complaints regarding late night and early morning commercial activity. That was in 2010. Approximately 2011, I think we started to get some traction with staff. Some recommendations were made to reform the fishery. It's disorderly by virtually anybody's definition other than the industry themselves. Those regulations came from the field biologists. They came to Olympia, and unfortunately, due to opposition from the industry, any reform of the fishery failed. Group of homeowners and citizens, and I was not part of this initially, got together with Senator Mary Margaret Haugen, got Senator Haugen up to speed, met with her at her home. I got involved to give them some of the biological studies and everything that had been done about smelt population. The senator reached out to staff. Those connections were starting to take place. We thought we were going to get some traction. Unfortunately, the five-term incumbent was defeated in November. So we lost momentum once again. I've now reached out to Senator Bailey's office asking for help to see if there isn't some way we can get the situation under control at the north end of the island. There's been identified as 259 miles of shoreline in Puget Sound that's suitable for smelt spawning. 75% to 80% of the commercial smelt harvest happens in just the 4 miles of shoreline along the north end of Camano Island. It's in too much, in too localized area. We need some changes.
Thank you. Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gordon, I grew up spending all my summers on Camano Island, so I'm familiar with the history of the smelt abundance and interest by the public. And one of the things that happened when I was a youngster there at Madrona Beach is they had a railway where they launched the recreational boats from a building. And a little pier was built there. And every two nights a week, they would put the light out over the end of the pier and wait several hours. Then they would seine for smelt because they had herring. They had live herring for bait fish for the fishermen in the mornings. But one of the things that was obvious to me back then, not knowing much about it at the time, was there was an awful lot of juvenile salmonids that were part of the catch of bait herring. Any idea, any knowledge of impacts on salmonids during these commercial smelt fisheries in the area?
I don't think, I mean, just from talking to staff biologists, I don't think that there's a lot of effort made to actually examine the catch when it's being brought in. But you're right, it's a beach seine. There, it's right along the same path of the migration of the salmonoids. And so there is a lot of bycatch, and there's no effort to serve. I mean, it's not just salmon, it's perch, it's a lot of other things that go with it. But no, the fish are all just pulled out, dumped into totes, and hauled away. Another, I mean, just one of the other problems we're having is just, I mean, there's a one of the in, it's in the information I sent you, is there's only a small number of commercial fishermen, but one fisherman was busted last year, never recorded a catch. They didn't report any catch, so they don't really have an idea of the total amount of smelt that's actually coming out of that region. There's been kind of chronic underreporting by the industry, but it just statistically it just seems wrong to take that much out of such a concentrated area when it is available elsewhere.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next person is Bruce Barnes. Could you come forward, please?
Good morning. My name is Bruce Barnes. I live in Vancouver, Washington. Thanks for the opportunity to speak here. And, you know, if I can come here and complain, I can certainly thank people. I'd like to thank David Jennings, the commissioner here, for getting back to me on my issue, you know, and being an open ear, and also, Nate Pamplin for explaining what he could explain. But I'm here to talk about hoof rot. I know it's on the agenda tomorrow, but I've got other things to attend to, and I'm meeting with some state representatives tomorrow on the hoof rot issue. So my concern is the department is managing for dollars, not the resource. And it's very evident when you look in the Fish and Game pamphlet this year at the number of tags that are given out. And by also being given the information that was provided at the Western Deer and Elk Conference, I don't know if anybody on this commission has got that information. Please raise your hand if you had. Because they talked about, in that information, how all of our elk in Southwest Washington are in very poor body condition. It's one of the contributing factors to why these elk have all got hoof rot and they're all sick and dying. It also stated in there that it was the third biggest die-off in our state's history of elk in Southwest Washington and Mount St. Helens area. Now I'm trying to figure out why this information isn't available to everybody else. Why are we keeping this a secret that there's a huge problem here? And I'm going to echo what Mr. Jennings said here. It's not only the frogs dying here, it's our big animals here dying also. And if you looked at CSNBC this week on the news, they talked about all the agricultural areas in California. There's four places there that are the dirtiest places in America to live. And they're dirty because of all the agricultural spraying, which we're doing on all our timberlands, that are killing all these species, including the animals and birds and everything else. And we're doing nothing to these timber companies that are spraying this defoliant that's obviously killing these elk. I mean, it's a man-made situation here that we've got. It's over-pursuit, it's defoliants, it's lack of habitat. And we've got a commission here that's supposed to be doing the best thing for our fish and wildlife, and we've got an agency here that is hired to take care of our animals and obviously not doing a very good job. We've got a huge problem here. I mean, huge. And after talking to Nate Pamplin and him stating that they really didn't believe the call-ins from the folks that are telling them where all these hoof-rotted animals are, because I think that they're really afraid that this thing is way bigger than they ever thought. You know what I mean? Honestly. And I'm quite sure the director, I'm quite sure you know this thing is, you know, it's a major deal here. We need to bring this out into the public and have some public meetings in all these different areas and ask for some ideas. And I know they want to put a citizens advisory group together. I know that the state senators and legislators are putting their own group together over this whole situation. But we've got a broken situation here that we really desperately need to be fixed. You know, I don't want my kids looking at these animals in the zoo and saying, hey, my dad and I used to be able to hunt these animals. We've got to do a better job managing. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Marcia Dalen.
Hi, my name is Marcia Dalen, and I founded the Raptor House Rehab Center for Birds of Prey in 1998. Now I'm here in regards to, and a little early, for the Raptor Rehab Program. Now, I have concerns with the new rehab laws that you're talking about putting into place. One of those concerns is requirements to get your rehab permit. That requirement should be that you must be a Washington State resident. Unfortunately, we do have somebody who is working as a rehabber that is not a Washington State resident, in which they are collecting funds from our wildlife program. And I don't think that is right, nor is it correct. One of the other concerns I have is regarding subpermittees and the definition of a subpermittee. A subpermittee should be a person who works directly under the constant and direct supervision of a permittee at their facility, i.e. permittee and subpermittees must live and reside in the same state. The subpermittees must be under the direct supervision of the permittee at all times. If you have interstate situations, the subpermittee who is in one state and permittee in another cannot be supervised, in which our wildlife is being mishandled. And that is not correct. Another issue I have is with falconers. Now, I'm a master falconer. I have been working with Birds of Prey for 21 years. I have studied in South America. I have not only worked my butt off to help Birds of Prey in Washington State and also to help in stopping individuals who were poaching eagles, in which I work directly with enforcement officers on. And when we have falconers who are taking in rehab birds, never seeing medical care, utilizing them for the sport of falconry, that is wrong. Those birds need to have rehab care, period. So allowing falconers to be able to take them without having the necessary education and background is not correct. Because I've seen a number of falconers as a master falconer who are both general and master level that should not be allowed to touch a bird. I have seen this on more than one occasion, and it makes me want to puke. Another issue is if you are going to help a rehab facility as a falconer, I think that's a great idea, but it needs to be monitored by that rehab facility at all times. The rehab...
You can finish your sentence.
Okay, thank you. The rehab facility should only allow falconers that are of master level with an eagle permit to handle both bald and golden eagles. And we have, unfortunately, in this state, falconers who are handling eagles that are not qualified.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. We've got some questions. Commissioner Jennings, and then...
First question is to the director. So are we talking about proposed WAC changes that will come in front of the commission at some point?
Yes, we are. I believe that's what
Marcia's speaking to is the proposed WAC changes. Sorry. Yes, I'm understanding that what Marcia's bringing to the commission are her comments relative to WAC changes that are going to be in front of the commission.
That's item number 10.
3 o'clock.
I'm sorry.
Leave.
Thank you. Yep.
This afternoon.
So you talked about your second point was about state residents and if one is in the sub-permittees in another state. So are you talking about, for example, on the border of Washington and Idaho, and somebody's living on the Idaho side who wants to work with a permitted person in Washington, the current language would not permit, the proposed language change would not permit that? Is that what you're telling?
Well, basically, it used to be in the language, which I have watched disappear. In that language, you used to have to be a Washington State resident to be able to have a Washington State rehab permit. And it has, there's a couple of organizations that are in Oregon that are utilizing birds from Washington State.
Rehabilitating birds?
Rehabilitating birds. So they are going across state lines and not coming back, which then means our biologists cannot go there. They cannot see the facilities that they have, whether they are adequate or not, and whether those birds are receiving the necessary care.
So your point is that the proposed WAC should have a requirement that the person be a Washington State resident?
Correct.
Because I actually heard just the opposite, so I'm glad I asked for that clarification.
Yes, because what I have seen was it used to be in there, and I've called all other states to find out if they allow it. Only Washington State is the only state that has allowed out-of-state rehabbers to cross into our state lines.
Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of a new subject to me, but to me, I guess, very simplistically, if the birds are being rehabilitated, I guess that to me is a bigger picture other than where. Is there some economic connotations to this that we need to understand?
Well, yeah. You know, I'm a taxpayer. I pay a great amount of taxes to Washington State, in which some of that goes to, I would hope, to rehab. But we have an out-of-state individual who is getting our Washington State funds for rehabbing through the WDFW grant. I don't think that's correct. Those should stay in Washington State.
Okay. Commissioner Kaney is next.
Thank you, Marcia, for showing up. I don't know much about this subject either, but Marcia and I did talk last week a little bit. And I'm curious, is the rehabbers organization, I know we have some rehabbers up in Okanagan County, I mean, are you at all in an organization that could have some effect on WAC rules or come forward as a group, or is it mostly just individual folks out there doing the good work of rehab?
Well, you know, generally the rule of thumb is that rehab facilities work together as a team. So, for instance, and we had this happen to us. We got a phone call about a bald eagle that was hurt over on one of the islands. None of the rehabbers was able to go and get it. We made the phone call to try to get someone to get the bird gathered up. And so, yes, we do work together. At least you attempt to try to, for the one purpose of saving those animals that need that help. But, you know, when you're crossing state lines, you know, if you've got birds that come in there diseased, which are one of the first indicators to diseases that come to humans, they're going across state lines. Yes, I realize they're migratory birds, they could fly there, but if it's down on the ground in Washington, it's not flying. It's not flying for a reason. Because it's either sick, diseased, or just about ready to die. Why is that? I don't know. But if it is something that a person can get and can become an epidemic, don't you worry about that going across state lines? I do.
Commissioner Smith was next.
Thank you. Just a quick question, and thank you for your good work. How many rehab permits are we talking about in the state? And this is a new...
You know, we have a lot of rehab permits throughout Washington State. So there are qualified individuals all throughout the entire state.
Do you have a rough number what a lot is?
Oh, boy, I don't know the exact number. You know,
Joe just said 71.
71?
Okay.
Director Henderson?
Well, I know the commission has a lot of interest in this topic. There's a briefing scheduled for this afternoon at 3:05, or scheduled for 3 o'clock. some of the questions that you're asking are contained in the green sheet that's in your briefing book. So I'm certainly not trying to stifle questions of the witness, but we are going to have a complete briefing this afternoon with a public comment opportunity associated with that agenda item.
Yes. And we afforded Ms. Dalen this opportunity because she's not going to be available in the afternoon. So you are anticipating a lot of the information that will be presented to us. Commissioner Perry?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one question. You mentioned this cross-state problem. How extensive is it? How often does that occur?
Well, we're talking about a fairly large number of birds. You're looking at well over 400.
No, I didn't mean birds. I meant the individual situations where somebody might have their rehabilitation facility on close to the border where there would be a problem, as you described.
Well, I know, you know,
that occur.
It occurs on a regular basis with only a couple of different rehab facilities. You know, for instance, you know, mammals are not supposed to go across state line, period, in which we have black bears that go to Idaho. Birds of prey, yes, I understand they're migratory, that they can fly across, but if, like I said, if they can't fly, there's something wrong. You know, I worked in a zoo. I've seen zoonotic diseases up front, in person. And do you want an epidemic? Honestly, because you're asking for an epidemic of one kind or another. Matter of fact, I remember when West Nile first came, we got the first of 8 West Nile red tails. Do you know not one went back to the wild? Not one.
So there'd be, what, 2 facilities that would have this?
There's 2 or 3 different facilities that are, in fact, doing this. The one facility that takes in a great number of raptors going cross state line is over in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we'll carry on this conversation this afternoon. Sorry you won't be around.
I wish I could be here because I have so much to say. But I do have pamphlets that has all that for all of you.
And our audio tape's always available at our website, so you can hear what the conversation has been.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. The final person is Ron Garner. Ron, I already told the commission what you said to me, Ron, so...
Well, I can't repeat it. There's some real news here that Aaron was going to hand out. Did she bring him up? I can go get him.
Oh, no.
I'll get him.
Yeah. This doesn't count in his 3 minutes.
It's the one with Ron on the cover.
Hurry up. There's a certain amount. Sorry.
God, you're wasting your time.
They're trying to take him out there. So, good morning, Madam Chair, Commission, Deputy Director. It's good to be here on great terms to talk to you about some things that the Puget Sound Anglers have done. As per our conversation, we did some great things this year. I was really glad to see it was the rockfish descending device out on the halibut grounds in the North Coast. As you know, last year we lost a month off our deep water fishery because of poor recognition of... I see Larry went right to the funny pages, but... Anyway... we went out and we were able to get fish descending devices. Puget Sound Anglers bought 300 devices from Shelton Products, and I've known and talked with Bill Shelton for quite a few years, and he threw in an extra 100 for free just because he believes in what we're doing. So, you know, hats off to Bill for doing such a great job. So we were able to get 380 of these devices into people's hands out there on the North Coast. 700 flyers. Billy Brooks, after talking to him that runs a La Push Marina, wouldn't let you launch your boat without one, and then handed him one. So everybody had them. After the first day, I was able to run into enforcement, track them down and talk to them, and they said their feedback on the water was less than half the floaters than the year before, and only two yellow eye is all they counted out of the floaters. So, and also, it's going to be June before we get all the data back to see how we did overall, but I think it was very, very successful. Everybody I talked to had good things to say on the way out, taking them out. I ran into people at gas stations, and they just flocked like seagulls with something on the beach there. And we handed out fish to sender devices. But after my conversation with enforcement, they said only one person did not have a fish to sender device on board. And so I reached in the truck and gave them a whole bag of them. I said, here, hand them to whoever you run into that doesn't have them. And I'm just really happy to report it seems like we might have turned the corner and saving some more of our fisheries. It was just really great to get out there, and I really want to thank Heather Reed. Without her going out and doing the proper education beforehand and kind of getting people in tune, it wouldn't have happened, I don't think, without her at all. And I know Michelle Culver's had a lot of things to do with this too, and working with Pacific Fisheries Management Council. But I'm ecstatic at where it went. About 8-9 years ago, I was recompressing rockfish. And I would even go to friends and tell them how to do it. And I'd see them on the water, and they still weren't doing it. And I never thought this day had come, especially how good it went. I would have never guessed it would have gone half as good as it did, but it went excellent. I think we'll see where the feedback is probably the end of this month. But I do have one concern out there, and that's the abundance of ling cod. We really had a hard time getting halibut because of the amount of ling cod. And you can see on the front page here the size of the ling cod we've got. So there is a lot of huge ling cod. Halibut grounds the first day, we struggled through a lot of ling cod to get three halibut. So that might be something we want to talk about in the future here, Phil. I don't know what your feedback is on ling cod and how many, but there are a lot in the ocean now since we implemented the 120-foot line. So I just like to just share what I saw out there and appreciate everybody's enthusiasm.
Great. Thanks, Ron. Commissioner Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You'll see my ignorance. What is a fish descender?
Okay. I do have a piece of paper here I can show you. We take rockfish back down. So when you bring rockfish up.
Thank you.
When you bring them up a little bit too fast, they can get barotrauma to the point where their stomach comes out and their eyes distend. And they seem dead, but they're not. We had one giant Picacho we had out there. This year you can't keep rockfish, so we had to take the rockfish back down. So we had one Picacho. It's probably the worst case. Stomach 4 inches out, eyes bloated. And we put him on a fish descender device. My son did. We took him back down about 240 feet. You know, he was really motionless. This has been the problem. Everybody thinks they're dead and they're not. So we took him back down about 240 feet and he thought he popped the fish off, but he didn't. At about 200 feet, when he started coming back up, the rod went crazy again. It was just diving like crazy and shaking and said, stop, the fish is still on there. And so he gave it one more good pop, which meant the fish came back to and was fighting well and then was gone. So overall, you know, the next step, I think, is teaching people how, and a lot of the data I feel is wrong that you bring them up fast. It's written a lot of places, bring them up fast. That's the bad thing to do. I mean, if you bring them up really slow, a lot of times they can swim back down on their own. Their eyes aren't out. Their stomach's barely out inside their throat. But when you bring them up fast, they just blow up, and that can't be good for them. And one other thing we were doing, maybe, which might be a step down the road, is we took little tubing, like if you had a small coffee straw. When you take the rockfish off, if you slide it over the hook, it covers the barb. You can just take the fish right off without more damage to the fish. So these are things we still got to work on down the road, but I just feel really good that we got the first step out there and it went as well as it did. So,
Commissioner Mankin.
Congratulations, Ron. I think that's a great step forward. A question I have for you is do you have any idea how things are going in Oregon and California with regard to the use of descenders?
They're going great. In fact, I have to say we were sweating with Bill because Oregon ordered 4,500 of them, and he called me and says, we'll have them done for you on the 12th. And I said, there's no way, Bill. That's after our season's already mostly done. He goes, oh, well, okay, we'll get them done. And then next thing, we're cranking out the midnight crews, and I got them done plenty of time, but Oregon ordered 4,500 of them, and John Holloway from RFA in Oregon, they're doing some pretty neat things too that I hope we can work our way into. Some of the things that Oregon's doing is putting a 30-foot leader between their weight and their lure to keep them off the bottom. And this is things that he's doing. He got a small set aside from the commercials to go out and do a test fishery. And they're going after yellowtail, rockfish, and other things. So basically, that keeps you from fishing bottom fish that are on the bottom. And you can go after schools that are up high, suspended fish. So that was one of the things that's really neat. And I'm looking forward to working with John on this. I went down and talked to I was demanded that I show up at the roundtable meeting in Oregon. So I went down and talked to him, and Noah's really excited about this too. So, anything else?
Yeah, one program that I've heard that the Pacific Fishery Management Council had a forum on descenders, and there was a discussion by a gentleman from California on some progress that they'd made on one of the seamounts using descenders with cow cod and putting radio tags on them to see how long they had survived. Because the cow cod are pretty well tied to the surface of the seamounts, and generally they wouldn't move great distances. So it afforded them an opportunity to really look in detail at what was happening in survival after the use of descenders. And they were finding fairly high survivals of cow cod.
That's great, because cow cod is what our yellow eye is up here. That's their endangered fish in California.
Exactly.
So, no, that's great. I mean, this is really groundbreaking, but to look from 8 to 9 years ago, I never thought we could have done this. I really didn't. I was really disappointed in my friends not seeing it. Now everybody's doing it. And the Westport Charter Boat Association all have them. The LaPush has them, the LaPush Charter Boat. Nia Bay is doing it. I just talked with Jambo, and he wanted me to add what he thought was really good, because this is like a first step in the descender device. The really good ones, the sequelizer that works off barometric pressure. When you go down, it automatically pops open at a preset. The standard one is 50, 100, and 150-foot depths. The one they made for the Northwest that you have to special order is a 150, 200, and 250. Because probably the shallowest water we fish halibut and lings out in the North Coast is probably about 380, down to maybe 500. And, you know, there's areas out there that, I swear, the whole east side of the lower half of the prairie out there is solid yellow eye. I think there's so many that they've come up over the top, and there's some rock piles I have that pretty much nobody knows about. I don't go to them unless other people, I can't see other boats. But you get too far, and I looked at it this time, and it's probably maybe even a mile and a half from the edge. You'll hit yellow eye if you get 100 yards off this rock pile where we get the lings. And this year, there's been some really, really big halibut in there, over 100-plus pounds, but we started hitting lings again. The first yellow eye we just picked up and left, and went back to the known halibut grounds just so we stayed out of them. But, there's a picture on the second page of the yellow eye. And one thing that was really neat we discovered was there's a little curly tail. And you can put on your main line, which was really fast to do, was to take your descender device with a big weight on it and have it pre-rigged, and all you'd have to do is when you brought the fish up, this way you only had to have one on the boat if you have four people fishing, was pop your main line off, grab the fish, put him on, and pop it right back on this little curly tail, and within 10 seconds you're putting the fish back down. So, and it's really important to get it done really fast.
Okay. Mr. Carpenter.
Well, I just wanted to take a moment, Ron, and, this wouldn't be happening without your leadership and your organization, and I just, it's really neat to see this happen at the magnitude and the speed that it's going forward, and you guys should be proud of it. Keep up the good work.
We are. Appreciate that, and thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was going to say, too. This is a really great story, and it's just a win-win, it sounds like. Terrific work. Thanks.
There's more to come. We're not done. One thing I would like to add, later on we talk about the cabazons. I had some divers contact me, and they're saying there are so many sea bass back in the Puget Sound now. Not little ones, big ones. And I've been hearing that a lot this year. A ton of sea bass are back in the Puget Sound, as well as large copper and quillback. So it looks like the Puget Sound's kind of maybe turned the corner. I don't know if these are migratory fish, but I'm talking about all the way down to the Narrows Bridge. I'm hearing the San Juan's, Possession, Hat Island, all the way south. The sea bass are coming back. And I went into some videos of some of the, one of the divers that I know, and he swims through a group of big, I'm talking big sea bass, down to do videotaping of wrecks, and there was a lot of lingcod down low, but I was amazed myself at how many sea bass are back in the Puget Sound.
Thanks. So,
that was something I would like to add.
Thank you. Snuck that in. Okay, that concludes the open public input item on the agenda.